Hello, Gallatin Valley and online listeners. You are listening to KGVM Bozeman Community Radio, broadcasting at 95.9 FM and streaming at kgvm.org. I'm Roxana, and this is Desert Oracle Radio Replay. Well, do you have a favorite road where you feel like you can get away and kind of let your mind wander? Do you know it so well you also know when to be out there and when to avoid certain spots? Maybe we all have our own favorite roads. Ken is going to tell us about a road he knows and related topics. This episode was released by Ken Lane, March 30th, 2018. Here is Kel Becker Road. Or maybe it's Kel Becker Road. You decide.
Transmitting from the Mojave Wilderness in Joshua Tree, California, now is the time for Desert Oracle Radio, the voice of the desert.
Well, it's nighttime on the Mojave, it's nighttime out here in the desert, and it's a real nice night to take a drive. Just get out there on the highway, on the back roads. Oh, we will not go anywhere near the interstate, not if we can help it. And when we do, we're just going to cross over, like crossing a river full of metal and plastic alligators and other such stuff. Let's not worry about it. Come on, let's get the kids in the car. Whoever they are, somebody must know them. All right, then just me and you, you and I, let's get in one of these cars haphazardly parked here up on Yucca Mesa and let's hit the road. You gotta be careful we don't back into one of these Joshua trees or a sculpture or whatever. Watch out for that. Well, I don't know what that is. It's all right if we kick up a little dirt on the way out, especially once you're going past old Bill's trailer. He is an unpleasant character. I get the feeling he got dropped off by the sheriff's bus, the one that used to come out here from Los Angeles every couple of months, let the parolees out. I guess they figured it was like bringing a pet duck to the pond at the city park. I mean, there were a lot of ducks there already. I guess we'll take Aberdeen over to Yucca Mesa, get around the commotion, get around the fast food joints and the gas stations, get around the bank branch and the pawn shops and the Dollar General and the smoke shops and the tire shops. Nothing to see there. Move along. The road opens up a little going into Joshua Tree, and then it's real pretty through there. They call this the Gateway Parcel, a square mile of Joshua Tree forest right alongside the highway. Now that's a nice thing to set aside. You see all those spiky arms reaching up in the night? Boy, they sure look weird in the headlights. But we don't have to worry about Yucca Man, so close to town. Now we have our own problems right here in these little towns. And I regret to inform you we need to stop at the gas station in Joshua Tree because I'm running on empty again. Can't get where we're going on fumes alone. So it is written, so it is written. So I'll get the gas going. And you maybe stay in the car with the doors locked. I'm gonna run into the mini-mart. Stock up for the road. Get some coffee for now and something else for later. And boy, I hope you're not hungry because I'm not eating anything out of the mini-mart. Hot or cold, dead or alive, I'm not going to do it. And if anybody comes up and tries to yank out the gasoline nozzle and fill up their own beater, well, that taser is not a toy. It'll do what needs to be done, but for God's sake, hold it in the right direction. The little metal points face out, away from you. And then we say goodbye to Joshua Tree for now. The saloon looks like a real nightmare tonight. Remember when that place was empty most of the time? Remember going in there on like a Wednesday night? Back in the recession? The last recession, anyway. Well, you'd go in there and somebody would be up on the karaoke stage singing David Allan Coe. Well, one about when his mother got out of prison. And there were people passed out at the bar. There were people passed out on the picnic tables. A couple of Marines knocking each other around with pool cues. Well, one time I went in the back there to return my rented beer, as Ed Abbey used to say. And there was this character asleep on the toilet. Now look at these radio towers up on Antenna Hill. You know, we used to broadcast the program from that shack up there a couple of times. But the wind howls through the walls and everything's kind of a mess. Black widow webs everywhere. You know, it's one of my least favorite parts of spring, going into your shed or your office or wherever and having those sticky old black widow webs wrapped all around your head and your neck and everything. I mean, I know they need to survive, just like everybody else. I know they don't much bother people, but it gives you a bad feeling. Knowing that there's something with so much poison in it, and so you go around opening closets and the cabinets under the sink, like you're breaking the seal on Tutankhamun's secret tomb. Wary and nervous. Your little LED light on the back of your dumb phone shining in there, making nothing but more shadows. Let's see if we can get anything good on the radio out here for once. There's not a lot out here, not a lot of radio anywhere these days. But Hope Springs Eternal got the religious station there, God bless them. I'd like to buy that station. Run them out of town. I used to hike up to that tower up over on Garbage Wash. I'd stand up there on the mountain looking over the desert and think about buying that tower. Buying that radio station. Making a nice music station up there. One of these days, maybe not too long now, it's good to get on the road and start scheming. You know, all the best ideas come from a desert highway. Especially once you get past the hospital, and especially when you get past the CHP. Get past the jail, the sheriff's station, all that stuff. It feels good to leave it behind. Now, 29 Palms, it has some charms, especially the south side, the Oasis, all of that. But we are on the road, we are on the move, and we sure aren't stopping at the liquor store in 29. There's always some kind of commotion outside that place. Now, one time I went by there and I thought they had a rock and roll band set up outside, but all the stuff was for sale on the street. Amps and PAs and all of that. And the van was probably stolen too. It's a weird thing now how a couple of years ago, well, the millennials had made this whole romance out of living in a van. Boy, that was something we used to avoid at all costs. You did not want to wind up living in some old van. One of those yellowed white Econolines with some pervert hanging out the window in an animal mask, giving candies to the kids. I guess it had to do with the recession. And with the sad realization that lots of people thought they might never own a home, never have a place to call their own, would be paying banks principal and interest for the rest of their working lives because they could not afford to go to college without getting loans. Boy, what a racket. base of all of that, I guess living in a van and going from place to place seemed kind of romantic. Smelled like freedom. And then all of a sudden, these national park gateway towns, places like Joshua Tree or Springdale up against Zion or Moab or Sedona or Marfa, well, they have these vagrants living in vans everywhere, and to a rancher or maybe just some old desert rat with a couple of acres, a vagrant in a van gains no charm from having an Instagram account. The thing about a van is nobody can see what's inside. So all the information comes from the outside, like the out-of-state plates, the outdated license plates, or what's pressed up against a couple of visible windows. Garbage bags, dirty clothes, a sad-looking dog that needs a bath, that kind of thing. And so the younger people in the vans have lately learned that the only people who have affection for Instagram vagrants living in vans are other Instagram vagrants living in vans. Well, let's hope that people can afford houses again soon, one day. Nobody wants to be run out of every little town they roll through just because of the creepy-looking old van. You know, in the very early 1980s, there was a strange epidemic across America. Well, there were many epidemics, big waves of bad things. But one of the strangest was the phantom clowns and the phantom vans all over the country, starting up in New England, vanning out across America. Little kids were being hassled and harassed by these dirty clowns and dirty white vans. The clowns would try to get the kids to get in the van so they could torture them and kill them. But the kids always ran away. They always got away. No clowns got the kids. And the clowns were never found. It's easy to disappear in a white van, I guess. They're all over. Service mechanics, deliveries. And you know, all the television crews drive those big ugly white vans too. They're just a stain on the world if you think about it. Well, years went by and the clowns were never caught. And eventually people began to say, hey, you know that Stephen King had a book about an evil clown getting the kids? That's probably where all that started. But the Phantom Clown wave began the year before Stephen King's book, It, was published. The year before it was published. But the year after he finished writing it. People always ask writers where they get their ideas from, especially the writers who come up with things that really hit a chord with people. Clowns and such. Well, these ideas come from the people themselves. They've just come a little earlier. Now, let's stay on Adobe Road up to Amboy. You know, there's always a cop hiding up there on Utah Trail. And the sad part out here on Amboy Road is you really do want to open it up. 75 is just about right. But 55 is what's posted, so we'll keep it in the low 60s. Within the realm of deniability, as they say. What a game we play with the cops. If they don't shoot us first, you know, one day they will all be replaced with robots. That is not in dispute, and it's one day pretty soon. They've already got robot security guards wandering around Silicon Valley. They've already got AI lawyers. And the only real question is who will run the police robots? If they're run by the community, by people following a moral code, well, then we might be all right. If they're run by the kind of gangsters we've got in place at the moment, well, I guess we better get used to the Terminators. Just remember that we learned to fight the Terminators in the Mojave Desert. And that's where we learn, out among the Joshua Trees. In the movie, they claimed it was Mexico, but Joshua Trees don't grow in Mexico. They are, in fact, the indicator species for the Mojave Desert, which ends north of Interstate 10. Anyway, no Joshua trees around here. Now we're in the hot part of the Mojave. The low part of the Mojave. Creosote and sand. Little cabins here and there. Lots of places where cabins used to be before they exploded. Before poorly trained technicians and manufacturers of methamphetamine got involved. Weird houses out here, too. They start off with a little one-room cabin, and then they keep on building, and pretty soon you've got four or five or six rooms, maybe even a bathroom. And every room is a different height, and some are built on the foundation, some are on the patio slab, and some, well, you just don't know what, really. And it's kind of squishy, and there sure are a lot of centipedes and spiders coming out in the springtime. A giveaway of hello to the Palms, because we are not going in there before driving for hours in the night. No, that is not safe. It is not safe to be boozed up on a desert highway. Besides, we are almost out. We're almost out of civilization. Almost past the last dried up tentacles of civilization. Around this bend, over and around the pass between Cleghorn Lakes and the Sheephole Mountains, always give a friendly 30-second honk of the horn when you drive by that big dumb sign in front of that one guy's house. The election was 2 years ago. Maybe somebody should tell him. And nice and easy, down North Amboy Road, down the grade, past the salt flats, and speaking of gangsters, well, they're at work out here, too. They're back, they're back in the Jabba the Hutt Palace of Slime out there in D.C., and they're trying to drain the aquifers beneath the Mojave Desert. The aquifers that feed the springs that are the only source of water for the desert bighorn sheep. For all the wildlife out here. All the rare and beautiful wildlife. And the not so rare. Like these jackrabbits on suicide missions. I guess they get bored like everybody now and then. What else would make the buggers wait there on the side of the road until the one car on the highway is in striking distance? They're daredevils. Don't flip your car for a jackrabbit. I know somebody who did that once. He's lucky to be alive. Anyway, these mobsters are trying to drain the aquifer in a national monument. Mojave Trail's national monument. They're trying to drain it out of a hole they dug in Cadiz, just to the right of us here. The road is just ahead. The road in. You hook in to the right and go down to Cadiz. Oh, they've got pools of water just to show they can do it. We ought to go over there and take care of things. Someday soon. Some night soon, I mean. Night work. We might need clown masks and vans. We'll get what we need.
I'm Emily Silver with Curate Joshua Tree. I run a blog and podcast out of the high desert where I interview artists in their studio, creating kind of an oral history of what's being made out here creatively. And tonight is a group show at Outpost Project of artists that I've interviewed so far, will be interviewing this year in 2018, Ken being one of them. We have a nice crew. We've got Bob Dornberger. He's got a piece on the kitchen table with giant tongues out. So when you eat at the table and stay at the Airbnb of Outposts, you're kind of confronted with these giant tongues as you eat, which is really interesting. We have Stephanie DiGregorio. She's got a sculpture hanging over by the window in the kitchen with this log sitting on it. She's also opening a gallery with me called Unpaved that opens in the fall.
And this is your new gallery that's coming in this area, is that correct?
Yeah, it's coming in Yucca Mesa. It's going to be part of Curate Joshua Tree. We're opening our own space. And we've got Svetlana Shigroff's piece over the couch. Actually, that entire room of the living room and kitchen is very much a space moon themed room. Mars, moon, kind of how you would think of Joshua Tree. And so Kyle Simon's work is the big moon pieces, and he's built his own telescope. He's built a few telescopes, and they're photographs of the eclipse. And he just had a big show up at the Integratron called The Sirens. And the whole idea of this show is called Found. And a lot of the artists, a lot of creative people are drawn out here, music-wise, visual art-wise, writer-wise. And so a lot of people are transplants. And this show is basically all transplants of people that have moved out here and they've found the desert. They've come from all over the place. And even tonight, you can see it in the opening. You see all these people that come from all over the place. The wind is blowing and howling and are still wanting to be here to celebrate this moment together. I think that's kind of what the desert does. It weeds out people, but brings together these other people. So this lost and found idea. I had this anxiety early in the evening, like, is anybody gonna stay? It's windy, it's cold. And Harrison, who's got a really big painting there in the office. And hi, Eileen. And
you know, this is like a children's show. If you hang around, all your favorite characters are gonna come by.
It's like Pee Wee.
Welcome, welcome.
This is our girl.
I'm Eileen Schmelz. I am the founder and proprietor of Outpost Projects, Flamingo Heights, California.
Please tell me about Mojave Green rattlesnakes mating on your porch.
Sit here.
So I went for a dog walk one morning with my dog, and we were walking back. We went to the front door, and all of a sudden my dog started barking. And I looked over, and there was two Mojave Green rattlesnakes mating right by my front door.
Now, did they do this with flowers, or how does it go?
If only. I think it was a little less pomp and circumstance. So there's two Mojave Greens connected by my front door, having a good old time. Guy comes out in this big truck, and he has these two big snake sticks. He came out with a really thin plastic bag, like thinner than you would think that you would even have like as a trash bag in your kitchen, with these two sticks. And he pulled the two snakes apart, and the two snakes were not too happy to be interrupted in the romantic interlude. And they were hissing and rattling and doing their whole situation, not too happy to be separated. And he threw one into a thin plastic bag, like what you would find at like a Vaughn's shopping bag. He threw one in, and it was, you know, rattling and moving and hissing and not having a very good happy time. And I said, but couldn't they just bite through that bag right into your leg? And he was like, well, they could, but they don't. And he went off in his truck, and I said, well, what are you going to do with these rattlesnakes? Like, don't kill them. Please don't kill them. I said, no, we'll relocate them. And I was like, you know, will you send me a postcard? And then right after they left, all of a sudden, a huge red racer came whipping down my driveway. From my understanding, the red racers actually hunt Mojave Green rattlesnakes.
Stephen Biller, he has a long association with Palm Springs Life magazine and his
Biller content.
You probably came from the weirdest place of all.
I did. I came from Bombay Beach on the Salton Sea.
On the magical, depleted, weird Salton Sea with the weirdest residential development of, I think, any waterway in America.
Crazy stench. People who've been there for generations. And now we're seeing artists from L.A., hipsters, moving to the Salton Sea because it's cheap. They got space, and they can create with very little interruption. And the locals marvel at them. They're making art, and they're fixing up some of these little shack properties. And now there's one of them with a that's been redone is now the Bombay Beach Opera House. And last night we heard an aria. No matter where you were on this beach, it's streets. It's all the streets are numbered 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and then Avenue A, B, C, D, E, and all the way down to H. And no matter where you were standing in this little community last night, when that opera singer was singing that aria, boy, oh boy, everything stopped. The state of the sea is not good, but I think one of the biggest problems, there are so many jurisdictions. You've got two counties, you've got cities involved, you've got the state, you've got federal. So you have all these competing bureaucratic interests. And every once in a while, you know, once every couple of years, we hear of, you know, a study being funded and, you know, $1 million for this, a few million dollars for that. But, you know, this, we're talking about the largest inland body of water in the state of California, and a few million dollars isn't going to do a thing. And there are solutions to the Salton Sea, but I just don't think that there is as much will as there are potential solutions. It's one of the last places in the continental United States where migrating birds can stop and feed, and the sea is drying up, and there's very few fish left in there to feed on. And you know, you got tilapia in there, and that's about all that's living in there right now. And so it's a big problem for migratory birds. It's a big ecological disaster for humans and other wildlife.
You've been enjoying the sounds of Red, Blue, Black, Silver creating all this ruckus right here, right across the table from me, live tonight in our borrowed trailer remote studio up here at Outpost Project, Secure A Joshua Tree Show called Found. Eureka, we found it. We all might have been lost. We were lost, but then we were found. Look, on April 26th, we're doing a live radio show at the Palm Springs Art Museum. This is supposed to happen at 6 p.m. Get there early enough to park your car, or better yet, walk if you're close enough to walk. Maybe call the Yellow Cab Company. But it's on Free Museum Thursday, and there's the whole Village Street Fair thing going on in downtown Palm Springs. So get there with enough time, because we will knock out a couple of live shows, and then we can all walk around and look at the Warhols. Big Andy Warhol show. You don't even need a pocket full of money or a credit card or a rich uncle to get inside. You just come on in. You ever see those big silkscreen prints in person? That's a whole different deal than looking at them in an art book or a picture on the internet. From Amboy to Zizix and across the great Mojave Wilderness, the whole Mojave Wilderness, this has been Desert Oracle Radio. We are always on your radio on Friday nights at 10 p.m. You tune your radio dial to KCDZ 107.7 out of Joshua Tree, 29 Palms, Yucca Valley. And there it is. Just like in Kelso in the old days, late at night, tuning in a weird station. Oh yeah, and you can get Desert Oracle Radio in Kelso too. I've tried it. And you can hear us everywhere, all the time, on your favorite podcast player. Especially the Art 19 player. Thanks for listening. And good night from the Voice of the Desert.
It's the bottom of the hour, and you are listening to Desert Oracle Radio Replay on KGVM Bozeman Community Radio at 95.9 FM and streaming at kgvm.org. Well, as we get more clear nights this season, see what you notice in the sky, along with the stars. Why limit your viewing to nights? Our days have had lots of returning birds. Maybe you'll spot something more. Well, as the train is my co-host again right now, this next episode came from Ken on March 26th, 2021. Here is Mystery Swarm.
Transmitting from the Mojave Wilderness in Joshua Tree, California, now is the time for Desert Oracle Radio, the voice of the desert.
Night has fallen on the desert. I was behind the wheel a couple hours out of Los Angeles. The wind knocking around the semi-truck trailers, wispy clouds whipping around San Jacinto. Flipping through the satellite radio channels, feeling alright, pretty good, not bad, can't complain. Gene Watson singing honky-tonk, old dirty bees slurring poetry, the golden hour giving way to maybe one last blast of cold winter wind and the unreliable specter of precipitation. Gassing up at the Morongo Casino, always support your local tribe, and then the last stretch, open road to the 62. Just got to find a notch between the big rigs and the right-hand lane, safe as in your mother's womb. The grade, maneuvering through the tourists, making way for the hot rodders, ever cognizant of the fact that every couple of times you come up this canyon, there's a dozen Marine Corps vehicles splayed out over half a mile of right lane. Highway flares and young grunts standing guard. Why do so many of their vehicles break down? Is that part of the training? I mean, if they can't get between Camp Pendleton and 29 Palms without half the transports failing along the way, we might need to revisit our national defense strategy. Speaking of the Navy, some strange tales emerge this week. Strange tales of strange happenings around and aboard a flotilla of U.S. Navy ships doing their various exercises off the coast of California, around the Channel Islands. The story goes something like this. In the summer of 2019... not even 2 years ago, in the last normal summer before the shutdown, the freak-out, quarantine Earth, five naval destroyers were involved in multiple nights of bizarre visitations by brazen craft, zooming around the decks in low visibility on the open sea for hours at a time. The USS Kidd, along with U.S. Navy destroyers named the Rafael Peralta, the Russell, the John Finn, and the Paul Hamilton, endured the aerial harassment because nobody could do anything about it. All those destroyers, and apparently no ability to destroy. Or maybe they chose not to destroy, which is good of them, although it sort of defeats the purpose of a destroyer. In the last hours before midnight, the USS Kidd saw the most persistent activity. At one point, a bright white light hovered over the flight deck, effortlessly maintaining its position as the destroyer chugged through the ocean dark at 16 knots. Spotter teams attempted to identify the craft, but they were hampered by low visibility and overall poor conditions. Offshore fog. The story was first reported on Twitter by Dave Beatty, who keeps his eye on such things. And that strange military car industry website called The Drive pieced together the whole encounter and the various ships' relative locations. Now, some eyewitnesses described oval craft with no visible propulsion systems. Others simply recorded UAVs, unmanned aerial vehicles. Usually meant to describe drone aircraft, but perhaps not inaccurate in this case. For several nights, whatever these things were, they sure did keep the U.S. Navy company on the lonely nights at sea. Naval intelligence and the FBI got involved afterwards, and the top levels of Navy administration closely followed the situation, which remains unresolved, unexplained. So we'll just forget about it, let it wash back out to sea. But if at some point over the next year the Pentagon comes calling for a doubled or tripled military budget because of the terrible threat of spook lights hovering around naval destroyers, you will be in the know. And you'll know there's nothing new about these fairy lights buzzing around our machines of war. Thank you. The lights have often shown interest in our military operations and were first noticed following us around in the sky during World War II, when scores of pilots were trailed by the mystery shapes of light that displayed navigational intelligence and a kind of playfulness. They could never be caught or shot down or identified to anyone's satisfaction. The assumption was that the Nazis had something really hot. Something more like magic than any conventional aircraft on a conventional airframe. But when the American victors hauled away the Nazi technology and its many brilliant scientists, the Foo Fighters turned out to be a mystery to the Germans, too. A couple of years ago, our dull media dystopia was briefly brightened by the story of the Tic Tac craft that bedeviled aircraft carrier captains and Top Gun pilots off the coast of San Diego, but in broad daylight. The most dramatic encounters happened around the USS Nimitz, including the daylight sighting of a shimmering pearl-colored egg-shaped enigma that plunged into the ocean and just sat there below the waves for a few moments before vanishing into the depths of the Pacific. The strange activity has been going on for a long, long time. The Tic Tac UFO stories go back to the first years of our young century, but for much longer, those people inclined to second sight have noted that the Channel Islands and their much smaller sisters called the Coronado Islands, just off the coast of Tijuana, are haunted places. Things come and go from the sea to the air and back again.
This was most likely flying spider webs. And I haven't seen it, I haven't been there, but I heard this case referred to as flying spider webs, which I do know to exist. I have seen a similar thing in Europe 35 years ago, though I hate to admit this. However, there was no regularity to the shapes. I still put this down essentially as a natural phenomenon. The term essentially here means that the natural phenomenon I have in mind, generally as an explanation, especially of two cases which I learned from American bomber pilots, is that it is an electrical phenomenon of high altitudes. This particular case I still put down as a natural phenomenon unless I'm shown evidence, but not as a high altitude phenomenon and not as electrical. My general belief is this, that there is a very rare natural phenomenon which is observed rarely anywhere on Earth, but it seems to be a little less rare on the northern slopes of the Alps, what is known as ball lightning, and has been written up extensively in European scientific literature. I know of two other cases, reports from the ground. One comes from the Crimea, and one comes from Denver, Colorado. And this ball lightning consists of, we don't know yet how it originates, of a ball, luminous, usually bluish looking, between 6 and 8 inches in diameter, which moves very slowly. In other words, anybody that a walking speed can overtake it easily. The thing as a whole moves along electrical conductors, or say like a barbed wire fence, and it ends in two different ways. Either it blows up, literally speaking, in which case it causes a small amount of damage. I could say it causes the same amount of damage as 10 ounces of black powder exploding, but I don't know how much you have played around with black powder. But in other words, it would push a door in or something like that. The second way in which it disappears is that it seems to collapse in itself, which gives the optical effect of receding at an enormous rate of speed. Some of the UFOs reported by pilots seen when in flight fit this description, and I have a tentative theory which I haven't been able to work out in detail, lack of time, that these ball lightning phenomena in the upper atmosphere are probably caused by the presence of the airplane. If you have atmosphere with a high degree of electric tension, the presence of a metal object may cause this phenomenon. As I said, this is purely tentative. I may be proven wrong tomorrow morning, but I want to be proven wrong.
I saw one myself as a 13-year-old sitting on the beach at night with my uncle at Rocky Point on the Sea of Cortez. He was a Navy veteran and something of a desert hippie, and he was also a scuba instructor. And the waters of Puerto Penasco were legendary in those days. We were just sitting there on the little seawall talking after dinner, looking out on the Gulf of California. And an egg-shaped something or other was hovering over the sea, not too far offshore. Not quite as big as the moon, but plenty big enough to notice. We thought it might have been a trawler coming in, a fishing boat. But it did a couple of strange maneuvers that made us think twice. And then it just plopped down into the dark waters and disappeared. I remember something like a glow below that spot, just below the dark waves. But that might have just been the light fading in my own vision, the ghost of a bright light you still see for a moment in the dark. By the time of World War II, magnetic anomalies had been located and mapped around the Channel Islands and the Coronado Islands, too. From the concept of ley lines to the USGS, we have often paid special attention to the places where everything gets a little screwy. Sacred springs, old groves. There's a big anomaly off Cape Lookout, Oregon. That's where, on May 19, 1943, a young naval lieutenant, junior grade, L. Ron Hubbard, led his new PC-461 class submarine chaser into battle with a pair of phantom Japanese submarines. On its first night out of Astoria, Hubbard was in combat. when a 2 Navy blimps, 2 Coast Guard patrol boats, and another 2 subchasers all joining the hunt for the alleged Japanese submarines, which were never there. Hubbard was called back to port and his superior officers were a little bit unhappy. New orders. Deliver the USS PC-815 to port in San Diego. This occurred without incident, and from June 2 to June 28, Lieutenant Hubbard was based in San Diego. Hubbard and the USS PC-815 then took part in anti-submarine war games near the Coronado Islands, which, it should be noted, are part of Mexico, and at the time were inhabited. For reasons still debated today, Lieutenant Hubbard ordered an impromptu gunnery exercise, firing the big guns at the Mexican island of South Coronado. The shelling led to an immediate diplomatic crisis between Mexico and the United States. An unnecessary and unforced error in a time of global war. It was the end of Lieutenant Hubbard's command days, too. A naval investigation concluded that the lieutenant had disregarded orders, anchoring in Mexican waters without authority, and conducting unauthorized gunnery practice. Hubbard argued that he was tired and conditions were foggy, and his crew needed the practice. Vice Admiral Frank Fletcher wrote the following: "Consider this officer lacking in the essential qualities of judgment, leadership, and cooperation. He acts without forethought as to probable results. He is believed to have been sincere in his efforts to make his ship efficient and ready. Not considered qualified for command or promotion at this time. Recommend duty on a large vessel where he can be properly supervised." A month earlier, Vice Admiral Fletcher submitted a similar report to Fleet Admiral Chester W. Nimitz regarding the Phantom submarines off the coast of Oregon. It is noted that the report of PC-815 is not in accordance with anti-submarine action by surface ship. An analysis of all reports convinces me that there was no submarine in the area. Lieutenant Commander Sullivan states that he was unable to obtain any evidence of a submarine except one bubble of air, which is unexplained except by turbulence of water due to a depth charge explosion. The commanding officers of all ships except the PC-815 state they had no evidence of a submarine and do not think a submarine was in the area. Hubbard spent the remainder of his Navy days in various naval hospitals, complaining of various ailments: stomach problems, vision problems, aches and pains. Hubbard himself would later write that this sickbed time was crucial in his development of Dianetics, a self-help system he would later reimagine as a religion. He left the hospital and did not return to his wife and children. Instead, he moved into the Pasadena mansion owned by the pioneering rocket scientist and occultist Jack Parsons. A new era had begun. Magic rituals were performed in the Mojave Desert. An elemental was summoned. But Hubbard was soon on the move again, this time using Parsons' money in a yacht-flipping scheme that the great beast himself, Aleister Crowley, saw right through. Crowley wrote to Parsons, "I suspect Braun is playing a confidence trick." And he called Jack a weak fool, an obvious victim of prowling swindlers. As for the PC-815, the sub-chasing ship was cursed and known to San Diego sailors as the Jinxed Subchaser, and was kept out of active duty for 2 years when, on September 11, 1945, it collided with the destroyer USS Laffey in dense fog off San Diego. 5 minutes later, the burning PC-815 had sunk with one man lost to the sea. The wreckage remained a danger to ships traveling the busy channel until it was demolished with explosives by Navy divers in November that same year. An interesting side note, if you're waiting for the Philip K. Dick synchronicity, is that in the year 1938, before his wartime misadventures, L. Ron Hubbard underwent dental surgery and suffered something like a transcendent experience, triggered by the opiates that numbed his jaw. The result was a still unpublished religious text he called Excalibur, a manuscript so world-altering that, according to Hubbard himself, whoever read it either went insane or committed suicide. Well, maybe that's why the New York publishers all passed. For those pilgrims seeking the various desert places L. Ron called home, the best known is a handsome mid-century home on North 44th Street in Phoenix, Arizona, now a private residence that is listed in the National Register of Historic Places as the L. Ron Hubbard House at Camelback. It was here in 1952 that Hubbard began his local lectures on his own philosophy, a series of lectures titled The Golden Dawn. From Amboy to Zizek's and across the great Mojave Wilderness, this is Desert Oracle Radio, broadcasting from Joshua Tree, Friday night to 10 p.m., and at various times on our makeshift network of participating community radio stations from coast to coast. You can hear us on WOOL Wool FM in Vermont, and KZMU in and around Moab, Utah, and I believe we're still on Lookout FM in Hollywood and Burbank. You know, I'm not entirely sure there's a complete list of our community stations anywhere. Maybe somebody will make one and put it on our website, desertoracle.com. Thanks to Red, Blue, Black, Silver for the new soundscapes tonight. The podcast is available to all who have stained their souls with a cell phone. Desert Oracle Radio is the name. Support for this program comes from our friends who contribute to the cause on Patreon, patreon.com/desertoracle. And I'm your host, Ken Lane. Thank you for listening. And good night from the voice of the desert.
Thanks to Ken Lane and Red, Blue, Black, Silver for sharing their work on Desert Oracle Radio. Thanks all the volunteers and supporters of KGVM. We need you. And thank you for listening. By the way, what kind of unusual things have caught your eye in the sky or on the road? If you want to tell me about it, please leave me a voicemail or text. The number is 406-404-6246. You can hear this program live on the air at 95.9 FM Bozeman Community Radio, or you can stream it online at kgvm.org at 7 Sunday nights and 9 Monday mornings. Our past Desert Oracle Radio replay episodes are also available on demand on the kgvm.org website. I'll be back next week with more desert and mountain lore for you. Till then, keep doing good things, stay well, and sweet dreams. I'll have some sandhill cranes from Shan Burson at National Park Service to take us out.